We are pleased to have with us today Dr. David Daniel, a native of Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, who is a historian and theologian and educator who specializes in the history of the Reformation and Counter-Reformation in Central Europe, especially Czechoslovakia, Hungary, and Austria. Dr. Daniel currently serves as special advisor to both the Ministry of Education, Youth, and Sport of the Slovak Republic and the Presidium of the Slovak Academy of Sciences. His responsibilities include the development of international education, cooperation and programs, and fostering educational and scholarly contacts between Slovakia and North America. He also serves as a visiting professor in the Department of Czechoslovak History and Archives at Comenius University, teaching courses in early modern Slovakia and the Reformation. A regular participant in scholarly conferences and international congresses, Professor Daniel also has frequently addressed civic, religious, and academic organizations in America and in Europe. His studies, articles, and reviews on Reformation history, in particular in Czechoslovakia, Hungary, and Austria, as well as on other topics, have been published in journals in both America and Europe in several languages. He has held several major fellowships and research grants and is a member of numerous professional and scholarly societies. He serves on the board of directors of the Center for Reformation Research in St. Louis, Missouri, the 16th Century Studies Conference, and was a member of the Public Committee for the Humanities in Pennsylvania. A graduate of Muhlenberg College in Allentown, Pennsylvania, Lehigh University, Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, and Concordia Theological Seminary in Springfield, Illinois, he received his doctorate in European history from the Pennsylvania State University. From 1966 to 1969, he was pastor at St. John Lutheran Church of Hazleton, Pennsylvania, and during the 1969-70 academic year, Daniel attended the University of Vienna as a Fulbright Fellow. Upon his return to the United States, he served for 9 years as a member of the Department of History of the Barron College of the Pennsylvania State University, and during the 1974-75 academic year, taught at the Lutherschule in Hanover, West Germany, as a Fulbright exchange teacher. In 1979, he joined the faculty of Concordia Seminary in St. Louis, Missouri, serving until 1989 as an associate professor of church history and historical theology, as well as, after 1984, director of library services. From 1988 to 1990, he was a senior Fulbright Fellow in Czechoslovakia and was affiliated with the Historical Institute of the Slovak Academy of Sciences and Comenius University. He is married to Wendy and has 3 daughters. Therefore, we welcome back Dr. David Daniel.
That's what they told me. Thank you very much for the introduction, but I don't have 3 daughters. Would be nice, but don't have 3 sons either. I do have 2 brothers, and so that may be the mix-up. That's always astonishing when one comes in and hears an introduction which really is interesting and gives you a new piece of information. I am very pleased to be back on the campus of Concordia Seminary. Certainly I had not expected to return so quickly or to have the opportunity to address the students or the faculty of a place which I still hold quite dear in my heart and in my remembrances. When I left the seminary for what appeared to be a 1-year stay in Czechoslovakia, neither anybody here nor anybody there had an inkling of an idea of what would transpire in the next 18 months. Suffice it to say, we were caught up in Central Europe in a maelstrom. things have changed so rapidly, so unexpectedly, that even now, watching the nightly news about a unified Germany, I still think I'm in a dream. I still think that everything that is transpiring might be an hallucination, but it isn't. Things have changed so dramatically that for Americans to address themselves to the contemporary issues in Central Europe, it will be a tremendously difficult thing to do. I could talk about many things, about the current political climate, about the speed of the revolution and what it felt like to be in the 50,000 people who stood in the square of the Slovak National Uprising and called for the abolition of the Communist Party. I could talk about what it felt like to be working with young scholars and researchers who took great risks in order to bring about change in their country. But I don't think those are the things that will interest you. What I would like to do today is to generally sketch the history of one single problem. It's a problem that doesn't really exist here in the United States because it was resolved very early in our history. But it's going to be the problem which for the next 20 years is going to be at the heart of European development in Middle Europe, and especially is the problem that's going to affect what Christians in Middle Europe can do and what we can do for them. And it's a very simple problem, the problem of religious freedom and the spirit of freedom. That religious freedom and democracy really do go hand in hand. And the question is how to establish a free functioning church in a free functioning society where neither church nor state have been truly free for many a century. I'd like to begin in France, because on the 2nd of April, 1831, Alexis de Tocqueville set sail from France for the United States. He was accompanied by a rather boring man, Gustave de Beaumont. Boring, at least, if you read his works. De Tocqueville memorialized his impressions of the New World in his very well-known two-volume treatise, Democracy in America. He felt that you could understand the future by studying the present. And so he came to observe what was a thriving democracy in a relatively new and unsophisticated, and in the eyes of the aristocratic Frenchmen, a barely civilized nation. He expressed great admiration for the individualism, egalitarianism, and the genuine concern for personal freedom that he found in America. And very early in his visits, while in New York City, he penned the following note about the relationship between church and state, between religion and the spirit of freedom. Never, he wrote, have I been so conscious of the influence of religion on the morals and the social and political state of a nation. In France, I had almost always seen the spirit of religion and the spirit of democracy marching in opposite directions. But in America, I found that they were intimately united. Now, while de Tocqueville may have exaggerated the vitality of religion in 19th century America, his observation that the spirit of freedom and religious freedom were closely intertwined was remarkably perceptive. Democracy and the loyalty of citizens to its realization through institutional structures, which is what we mean when we talk about the spirit of freedom, were and are intimately bound together. This has been confirmed not only by the subsequent history of the United States, but also by even a cursory examination of the history of civilization in general. In societies where religious freedom does not exist or is substantially restricted, the spirit of freedom in a functioning democratic society seems difficult, if not impossible, to maintain. The free exercise of religion in a thriving democracy, which de Tocqueville observed in the America of the 1830s, was unique and of recent vintage. While many of the colonialists supported the revolution and the struggle for American independence, far fewer, including a significant number of the intellectuals and popular political figures, were ready to accept the principle of full religious freedom and pluralism. Even among the founding fathers, who were deeply influenced by the Enlightenment of the 18th century, unanimity did not exist. The mesmerizing orator of democracy and independence, Patrick Henry, supported the reestablishment of the Episcopal Church in Virginia. Thomas Jefferson and James Madison, on the other hand, worried about the tyranny of the minority over the majority. This principle, the principle of religious freedom, was only slowly accepted in revolutionary America. It was not until the establishment of the First Amendment to the Constitution of the United States, the so-called Bill of Rights, that religious freedom was written into the constitutive charter of our nation. It begins with a very simple phrase: Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. And then follows the whole stream of other freedoms which are based upon and related to this separation of church and state, including free speech and freedom of the press. Now, the priority of place given to the formal disestablishment of religion and the guarantee of the free exercise thereof in the Bill of Rights indicates that the allegiance to the principle of separation of church and state in the United States was growing. This separation of church and state and the religious freedom mandated and guaranteed by the First Amendment provided the legal conditions for the flourishing religious life that de Tocqueville observed nearly a half century later. And this flourishing religious life has continued in the United States down to the present. However, the concept that the free exercise of religion was essential for both human freedom and for the vitality of religion was far older than the Enlightenment principle incorporated into the First Amendment of our Constitution. Its roots go back beyond the Edict of Nantes to the first decades of the 16th century. I'm a 16th century historian, so you know I'm going to have to deal with the Reformation somehow. Among the early advocates of the legal separation of church and state were the radical Czech Hussites of the 15th century and of the Anabaptist reformers of the 16th. They held that the decline of Western Christianity began during the 4th century when the Roman Emperor Constantine formally accepted Christianity. As a result, the church became a state-sanctioned institution of civic control, as well as an instrument of social stability and cohesion. The state guaranteed the legal status of the church in society, sanctioned its administrative structure, and secured its financial basis. At the same time, however, this subjected the church to the intrusion and interference of political authorities in religious matters. This often tempestuous union of church and state, characteristic of medieval Europe, was opposed by the Hussites, the Anabaptists, and other early 16th century ecclesiastical reformers. They decried and condemned the intertwining of secular and spiritual authority. And on the basis of very similar theological principles, which emphasized the church as a community of true believers, they called for the strict separation of church and state. Not only did the established Roman Catholic Church oppose and persecute these reformers, burning or drowning them as pestiferous heretics, most of the other reformers of the 16th century, including Luther, Calvin, Zwingli, Bullinger, and Beza, were also hostile to the views of the Anabaptists and other radical reformers. These, quote, mainstream, unquote, reformers and the communities which grew up around them did not seek to separate church and state. Rather, they wanted to obtain legal recognition and toleration from the state for their own particular churches. At the same time, they were not willing to have this toleration extended to others. Their demand for legal recognition and toleration was not based upon a general concept of human rights, but upon the particular political privileges of both nobles and town corporations. Thus, for example, the Peace of Augsburg of 1555 bestowed upon the princes and cities of the so-called Holy Roman Empire of the German nation the privilege of establishing in their territories Lutheranism or Roman Catholicism, a circumstance which was expressed in the subsequently well-known phrase, cuius regius eius religio, whoever reigns his religion. The failure of the Peace of Augsburg to recognize or extend legal toleration to the so-called Reformed churches, whose theology was rooted, as you all know, in the work and ideas of the Helvetic or Swiss reformers, made further conflict within the empire inevitable. Only far beyond, in the eastern frontier of the empire and on the eastern frontier of Europe, was a broader religious toleration first established by the Diet of the Hungarian Principality of Transylvania, or Siebenbürgen, today the western part of Romania. In 1558, the Diet or Parliament of Transylvania presented to Isabella Zápolya, the Queen Regent, an edict which declared that each person can maintain whatever religious faith he wishes, with old or new rituals, while we, at the same time, leave it to their judgment to do as they please in matters of their faith, so long, however, as they bring no harm to bear on anyone at all, lest the followers of a new religion be a source of irritation to the old profession of faith, or become in some way injurious to others. Now, like the Peace of Augsburg of 1555, this edict extended legal toleration only to the Lutherans and Roman Catholics. However, during the reign of John Sigismund, the first and only Unitarian king in history, subsequent proclamations in 1568 and 1571 extended toleration to the four religious communities in the Principality of Transylvania. That is, the Catholics, the Lutherans, the Reformed, and the anti-Trinitarians. Religious toleration was also demanded by reformers throughout the other lands of the Austrian Habsburg Empire, a vast territory which today is distributed among the nations of Austria, Czechoslovakia, Germany, Poland, Romania, Hungary, and Yugoslavia. In 1606, after 15 years of armed resistance, Hungary wrested, by force of arms, legal toleration in the Peace of Vienna. In 1609, through the Letter of Majesty, issued by Rudolf II, the Bohemians were granted religious toleration in the Kingdom of Bohemia. The incipient religious freedom in Central Europe, then, at the dawn of the 17th century, lasted but a few years, really just about a decade and a half. Almost immediately, the Habsburgs resumed their efforts to assert their royal authority, especially in the area of religion. They accepted the assistance of a revitalized post-Tridentine Catholicism and of the institutionalized vanguard of Counter-Reformation, the Jesuit, Franciscan, and Piarist religious orders. In Middle Europe, the reigning spirit of the 17th century was not toleration, but rather absolutism and conformity. The Counter-Reformation in the Austrian Habsburg lands was based upon the absolutist attitudes of the Habsburgs and justified by the arguments of Justus Lipsius, who, at the dawn of the 17th century,
argued that the author of unity is religion, and therefore in a state there should be only one religion. The Bohemian Protestant opposition to the Habsburgs led to the defenestration of Prague in 1618 and the onslaught of the Thirty Years' War. For a generation, almost all Europe was at war. And then, as so often now, religious labels were attached to political aims, even though religion was but one of many of the causes of the conflict. After the Battle of White Mountain in 1520 brought both an end to the autonomy of Bohemia and the execution of a score of the Protestant leaders of the rebellion, the Edict of Restitution of 1629 ended religious toleration in Bohemia for 2.5 centuries. In Hungary, the resistance to the Habsburgs was also resolute and continued throughout most of the 17th century. Nevertheless, with the aid of the Jesuit order, military pressure, and the distribution of territory to loyal followers after the defeat of the Turks in 1683, the Habsburgs were able to severely restrict the activities of the Protestants in Hungary. The union of altar and throne, a common feature of 17th and early 18th century Europe, was particularly strong in the Austrian Habsburg lands and endured until the reign of Joseph II at the end of the 18th century, the so-called enlightened monarch. While certainly no advocate of democracy, Joseph II was influenced by the principles of the Enlightenment emanating from the philosophes in France. He wanted to rationalize the governance of his state, to establish a well-ordered, loyal citizenry. He paid particular attention to educational reform and sought to reduce the influence of religious authorities over the schools by placing education under the direct supervision of state-appointed officials. At the same time, he issued an edict of toleration for the Austrian, Bohemian, and Hungarian lands, which extended to Protestants in these territories new, if still limited, rights to practice their religion. Joseph II really chose selectively from the Enlightenment. He chose only that which would support his royal authority and his own presuppositions concerning the form and functioning of a rational state. He was no democrat, he was no nationalist. But others in his lands began to agitate both for greater political freedom and national rights. Especially significant was the number of Protestants, especially Lutherans, who emerged to lead the national revivals of the 19th century. Individuals who are associated, for instance, with Lutheranism in Central Europe include the Czech national leader, František Palacký, the Slovak national revivalist, Ludovic Stúr, and even the Hungarian, Lajos Kossuth. These individuals demanded national, political, and religious freedom for the respective nations and ignited the fires of nationalism and revolution, which ultimately coalesced to bring down the House of Habsburg during the course of the First World War. Attempts by the successor states of Central or Middle Europe, Austria, Hungary, Yugoslavia, Romania, and Czechoslovakia, to establish democratic forms of government after World War I met with only sporadic success. Even in Czechoslovakia, whose constitution was based upon those of America and the French Republic, religious issues provided additional fuel to the political conflicts and ethnic conflicts which raged throughout the fledgling democracy. Relations between the state and the Catholic Church, to which the majority of the Czechs belonged, were troubled by the government's emphasis upon the historic role played by the heretic Jan Hus and the Hussites in the development of Czech national consciousness. This also affected the relationships between the Czechs and the Slovaks. While Lutheran Slovaks generally supported the Czechoslovak state, the growing centralization of power in Prague and a perceived anti-Catholic attitude of Masaryk and other Czech and Slovak intellectuals, including Stefanik, led about 30% of the overwhelmingly Catholic Slovaks to rally behind the Catholic People's Party of the Slovak nationalist Father Andrej Hlinka. Now, while it might have been possible for the Czechs and the Slovaks to resolve their difficulties in a more pacific environment, the interwar period was a maelstrom. Czechoslovakia became the first victim of Nazi aggression. Hitler's annexation of the Sudetenland was followed by the invasion of Bohemia, the destruction of a democratic Czechoslovakia, and the formation of the so-called Bohemian Protectorate. At the same time, Hitler encouraged and recognized the formation of a separate Slovak state, the so-called, quote, Parish Republic, unquote, under the presidency of the Catholic priest and Monsignor, Dr. Joseph Tiso. In the course of its six-year existence, this fascist Parish Republic fell more and more under the direct influence of Nazi Germany and acquiesced to the deportation of Jews, Gypsies, and dissidents of all stripes to concentration camps, literally death camps, abroad. The proportion of Slovaks, Catholic, Lutheran, and Orthodox, as well as communists who opposed this regime, grew steadily during the course of the war. In August 1944, the Slovak national uprising sought to end both German influence in Slovakia and to bring down the Tiso government. The unified Czechoslovakia, reestablished after the defeat of Nazi Germany, did not last long enough to reestablish democracy or religious freedom. In the crisis of 1948, Czechoslovakia became one of the communist states behind the Iron Curtain and fell under particularly severe Stalinist influences. In accordance with the principle of so-called scientific Marxism-Leninism and democratic centralism, church buildings or property were confiscated, except for houses of worship. Church schools were closed. Religious orders were forced to disband. Seminaries were limited in number. The state paid the salaries, however, of the clergy, even though they were often nothing more than a pittance. It also approved, or more often disapproved, candidates for seminary training, for parish pastorates, or church offices. In order to survive, personally, or to secure the continued existence of the church communities in these communist countries, church officials often collaborated, either overtly or covertly, with the political authorities. They practiced self-censorship in the church press and even joined state-sponsored religious peace movements such as Terra in Pakis. The communist the communist state thus allowed religious organizations to exist, but severely restricted their activity. For example, the Czechoslovak constitutional law of 1962 did contain guarantees of religious freedom, but always with limiting provisions. For instance, Article 34 or 32, freedom of confession is guaranteed, period. Each may confess whatever religious faith he wishes or might be without confession, and also perform religious ceremonies, insofar as this is not at variance with the laws. Again, religious faith or convictions may not be employed as an argument that someone would refuse to fulfill the responsibilities of citizenship, which are laid upon him by the law. The provisions of these clauses, that everything be done in accordance with the law, was not benign, obviously. Through a whole maze of laws and bizarre regulations, the state sought not merely to control the churches and restrict the influence of religion, but to actively foster atheism and the principles of scientific Marxism and Leninism, especially in the field of education. Individuals who openly became active members of a church were not able to serve as teachers or to obtain advanced education beyond the level of a university training. They could not serve in the education department, nor could they bear arms in the military or rise to high office in the military. They could be only foot soldiers. What made the situation even worse is that even the so-called constitutional guarantees were restricted by another, perhaps most infamous clause, was the most hated article of constitutional law in Czechoslovakia. Article 4 states, and I quote, "The leading force in society and in the state is the vanguard of the working classes, the Communist Party of Czechoslovakia, a voluntary combat unit of the most active and most conscientious citizens from the ranks of the workers, farmers, and intelligentsia," unquote. This article means that all aspects of human life, even religion, was subjected not merely to state control, but to the control of the controllers of the state, the Communist Party. Thus, in Czechoslovakia, throughout almost all of so-called Eastern Europe, religion was subjected to the state, which was itself subject to the dictates of the Communist Party. No student could study at a seminary without the approval of the party. The party had a say in who was appointed to church offices, especially high church offices, or else the offices remained vacant. For instance, until this past year, 13 bishoprics of the Catholic Church in Czechoslovakia were without bishops. No church buildings could be built without prior approval by the state. And therefore, in the town or the section of Bratislava in which I live, there are 150,000 inhabitants in what we call paneloki, these concrete monstrosities they call apartment houses. There is not one church in this entire segment of the city. For 150,000, not one church, Catholic, Lutheran, or even Orthodox. There could be no new congregation which would be founded without state approval. Everything was controlled by the state, which meant it was controlled by the party. Some of the clergy, far too many perhaps, became willing collaborators and even apologists of the regime. Many others passively accepted its control to the detriment of religious life, not only in Czechoslovakia, but throughout Central Europe. But already during the Prague Spring of 1968, signs of discontent within the church were manifested. Discontent grew. This discontent grew, even despite the normalization movement of the 1970s. By the way, normalization meant that anyone who was suspected was cast out of whatever position he had. And therefore, in Czechoslovakia, you will find that there is a tremendous gap between the senior scholars, research, and government officials, most of them over 58, and the next generation, most of whom are under 42. Between the ages of 42 and 58, few people can be found in government or in high academic offices who are between the ages of 42 and 58, probably only about 10%. That gives you a sign of what normalization did. This normalization certainly, again, affected religion in society. But by the mid-1980s, when I first began to go to Czechoslovakia regularly, a small and significant group of dissidents existed, not only within the various religious communities, but also in the universities, and even in the Communist Party itself. In March 1988, something happened that very few people heard about in the United States. There was a demonstration in Bratislava of Catholics who protested the government policies toward the churches during a demonstration in Hviezdoslav Square. This demonstration was brutally put down by police dogs, truncheons, and water cannons. Five of the leaders of this reform movement were arrested and brought to trial in the summer and fall of last year, in 1989. Among them, Jan Czarnogórski, today Vice Premier of Slovakia, and Miroslav Kusi, who today is Rector of Comenius University. This trial of the so-called Bratislava Five was one of the forces which led to the mobilization of the populace, especially the Catholics, against the regime, and helped to fuel the student demonstrations in November 1989. Indeed, 2 days before the Prague demonstration in Bratislava, students from Comenius University marched to the Ministry of Education and demanded that the government, the university, the teachers, stop lying to them about their own history and their own tradition, and demanded freedom of thought, press, and religion. Throughout Eastern Europe, during the past decade then, religion has become increasingly a vehicle for expressing dissent. During the past 18 months in Eastern Europe, in Poland, in Czechoslovakia, in Hungary, in East Germany, in Transylvania, and in Bulgaria, the churches have emerged as centers of resistance to the dictates of the party and of totalitarian regimes it sanctioned. It was not surprising, therefore, that as the revolutions of 1989 spread from city to city, from country to country, and brought to an end the regimes which had for so long brutalized the citizenry, one of the first concrete results of these revolutions was the attempt to re-establish religious freedom. Except for Romania, where blood flowed in the streets and stained the snow of Christmas 1989. Christmas was celebrated far more openly than it had been for over a generation. In Czechoslovakia and East Germany, religious services were broadcast over radio and television in Czechoslovakia for the first time in 43 years. But as religious freedom seems to have been reborn in Middle Europe, there are disturbing clouds on the horizon. While many of the reformers had called for the legal separation of church and state, old traditions and old practices and old hostilities die hard. Since most of the clergy and churches of Eastern Europe were supported by church taxes collected by the state, and because no tradition of voluntarism or of individual giving and private donations exist, many individuals are now looking to the state to help subsidize religion. Some of the newly appointed bishops in Hungary and Czechoslovakia have even called for the establishment of compulsory religious education in the schools. Individual clerics were using their pulpits to support individual political candidates in the recently held elections in Central Europe. These events and developments are disturbing. They are disturbing because they raise the specter once again of not only state support for religion or involvement in religion, but state control of religion. Or even worse, church control of the state, which would bring out all sorts of ethnic, social, and political problems. Therefore, many individuals in Middle Europe are reconsidering the traditional means of organizing and funding religious life. They realize, on the one hand, that the social traditions and economic realities of Middle Europe may make it difficult, if not impossible, for them to establish immediately fully self-sufficient, independent churches. At the same time, they recognize that the churches must become self-sufficient and independent of the state, both for the benefit of individual churches and for the benefit of the state. These individuals have begun to reflect upon the American experience and to seek guidance from it. Many of the people in Middle Europe have rediscovered their religious heritage as they sought and seek to find their political freedom. But they also realize that they must avoid the mistakes of the past if the freedom they have finally obtained is to endure. They know that the spirit of freedom is nurtured by, and in turn nurtures, religious freedom. But for the old world, the American experience of free churches and a free society is as new and unfamiliar and challenging a world as the democracy they have just claimed. And therefore they cry out to North Americans, and especially to people in the United States, come and teach us. Help us to find a way to develop our own churches in our own new free society. And it will not be easy for them. I'll give you some very simple, clear figures. The average salary of a worker in Czechoslovakia today, an intellectual worker, is about 3,000 to 4,000 crowns, gross. Net between 2,500 and 3,500 crowns. That is approximately what I make. That translates to about $120 a month. The churches of Central Europe are old and crumbling. There are few resources to build them or to repair them, to bring in the basic resources that they need. We might talk in terms of 500,000 to 1,000,000 crowns per church building. These are historic monuments and need to be preserved. The average donation on a Sunday morning from a congregation which has on its rolls 2,000 but only 25 to 35 in church might be from each person a crown. From the more well-to-do, perhaps 2 to 3 crowns. There are just no resources even to pay the day-to-day cost of operation, much less to preserve what is there. What about printing presses, mimeographs, typewriters, computers? I was recently talking to the evangelical bishop, a leading bishop in Bratislava. Plea was a computer, a small XT, something to manage the finances and administration of the central church office. The entire church is run with handwritten notes and a few typewriters. Most parishes, the only typewriter you will find will be that personal typewriter of a pastor who has given perhaps 1 month's salary to purchase it. But even more, how do you do evangelism? How do you develop a sense of voluntarism in the church? These are their problems. How do you proclaim the gospel in a society where people have been afraid to speak openly about anything? And now you want to go out and have people make confession in a very volatile society. These are the questions that these people are facing. The influx of Western culture began a long time ago. The culture of heavy metal rock is well established in Eastern Europe. But they know that there is something more. The people of Eastern Europe are searching for a new spiritual vitality. They knew that they were immoral men in an immoral society. And they know that immorality will continue. But they want to build a moral society even with immoral individuals. What this means is that they need a sense of the gospel. Because what does the gospel do? It recognizes that we are all sinners, that we have all erred, and that it's only at the foot of the cross and in the blood of the Lamb that we are bespoken righteous through the proclamation of the forgiveness of sins. Whether it be the sin of collaboration or the sin of conformity or other personal sins. And it's only on that basis of forgiveness and the willingness to proclaim that forgiveness that the people of Eastern Europe are finally going to be brought together and overcome not only the burden of their sin, but the burden of their history. What can you do? Right now, very little. I must be honest, you, we, in the Missouri Synod, Lutherans in America, have ignored Central Europe for 45 years. We have not borne their pain. And we will not find it easy to make gains. But if we go with a spirit of help, of understanding, of a willingness to help them where they are, to assist them to learn how to proclaim the gospel, to help them by providing the means to establish their ecclesiastical communities, then we can accomplish the call of the Great Commission to go into all the world and teach them all that I have commanded you, baptizing them in the name of the Father and of the Son and of the Holy Spirit. And this is, after all,
what you and what I and all Christians, wherever they might be, have as our first commandment. Thank you.
We've got just a few minutes. If there are some questions, we can certainly take those at this time.
Oriental religions are tremendously fascinating in Czechoslovakia, as are the sects. Jehovah's Witnesses are there. The Adventists have been there for a long time. Remember, the established churches have for so long been identified with the state that they have lost their integrity. They're going to have to regain it. Several ways they responded. One was the creation of house churches. One was that many Lutherans left and joined other denominations. And one was that they ordained women. That was the only way they can get pastors. And simple, straightforth answer.
Thank you for having been with us this morning.